must we let it end? Where does the time go? Gone too soon, my friend. And where go the echoes of our laughter ringing the air? Oh, wherever the time goes, I will see you there.
The time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end? And where go the echoes of our laughter ringing the air? Oh, wherever the time goes, I will see you there. I will see.
This is WHFR Dearborn, and now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. It's our public affairs show, folks, and we're here talking about local issues and sometimes between the lines, putting in our own opinions. And, of course, any opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of Henry Ford Community College. Remember that. My co-host today is, again, our WHFR news director, and that is Dennis Reimars.
Hello, Dennis.
Hello, Dennis.
Okay.
Good check.
And our special guest in the studio, and it's not the first time we've talked to him on WHFR, but usually it's out and about at some community event like Dearborn Homecoming or sometimes Dearborn Farmers Market or whatever, but 19th District Judge Mark Summers. Welcome to WHFR Journal, Mark.
Nice to see you, and great to be indoors on a day like today.
Well, yeah, I bet. Your career in Dearborn started, you were elected to the 19th District Court as one of its judges back in 2002, and you were reelected in 2008. So technically, you were able to continue in that post until 2014. Just the first question I'm going to start with, then we'll do a little background here, but you're actually thinking of changing venues, if you will, of perhaps running for election in it's not a district court, it's a circuit court.
Third Circuit Court for all of Wayne County. Actually, at this point, we have collected more than the minimum required signatures. I intend to file those signatures along with the required other paperwork and submit my name for the ballot for the August 7th primary. So.
Well, you certainly have. I don't know. Have you counted out how many cases you've had in the last since 2002? I bet they'd be kind of scary. The caseload is pretty heavy at most courts.
It is. The 19th District Court is one of the busier district courts in the state of Michigan, actually. We average over 68,000 cases a year, if you count everything from parking tickets through felonies. Mm-hmm. If you want to talk about the cases that take more of the judge's time, I handle on average between 2,500 to 2,700 misdemeanor cases every year, and anywhere from about 180 to 250 felony examinations. So that's the heaviest part of the docket. So you multiply that times 9 years and 3 months, and you've got a pretty good idea on that side of things, what I've been doing with my time.
I would hate to try to divide that into 24 hours of a day. They're very long days, I assume.
They are very long days. Now, in fairness, some of these matters literally take minutes of the judge's time, but other matters take hours and sometimes days. Okay. I just finished a trial that took 7 days.
Wow. Okay. Let's talk for those listeners who may not know about the district court, although it is different in terms of the types of cases that it will have come in front of it than, of course, the circuit court. And I happen to have the list in front of me, so I can just read it off here. Apparently, civil cases, now that's not a criminal case, it's a civil case, and if someone is found guilty of something in a civil case, they just pay money. They don't go to jail, apparently. Well, that's when the dispute is less than $25,000. Boy, that almost seems like a felony case if it's over 20, but it's still technically a civil case. And apparently, is it parking and moving traffic violations are also considered civil cases?
Those are civil issues. I'm going to just...
Go ahead.
Correct a word there. In a civil case, you're not guilty of anything.
Oh, I didn't know
you
that.
You can be found to have, for instance, violated a contract and be liable for the breach of contract. Okay. You could be found to have been negligent if it's a negligence case. Mm-hmm. And I guess you could use the word loosely guilty of having been negligent. But unlike a criminal case, the burden of proof is what we call a preponderance of the evidence. Mm-hmm. And that means does the proof in favor or the evidence in favor of the proposition outweigh the evidence against it? So the classic terminology would be even by the weight of a feather has somebody proved their case. So in the civil arena, that's how we discuss that.
I think many years ago, the O.J. Simpson trial, if people are old enough to remember that, the one that was sort of the first year of court TV that every minute was there and all this debate and from people who didn't really know what was going on even. But he was found not guilty in a criminal court of murdering his wife, but then there was a civil case brought about by the relatives of his wife, right, and he was found guilty in that.
Right.
Had to build up a trust fund for his kids' education, which I don't think he has even done yet because he's currently back in jail again for another reason. But that's an example of two similar charges against one person, innocent in one because of the burden of evidence for a criminal case, as you said,
beyond
has to
a reasonable doubt.
Right. So it's just if you quote unquote lose a civil case, if the ruling is against you, that's as far as you go. You have to sort of make good on what you did by paying money.
Generally, that's the compensation that the law can award someone. Civil cases may also involve injunctive type relief, where someone is ordered not to engage in certain conduct or is ordered that they shall engage in certain conduct as a civil remedy.
And you actually heard the case of Terry Jones, who tried to do a protest in Dearborn and was held back from doing that the first time because I think it was on Easter Friday or something.
Good Friday.
It was planned for that, and it was going to be in the very, very busy sort of Church Row area that we have.
And you have managed to strike that rare earth that lies between the criminal and the civil cases.
Mm-hmm.
That is a kind of proceeding that might be referred to as quasi-criminal. It's that kind of strange world where you are enjoining someone from a specific conduct. A similar type of law would be the personal protection orders that are issued at the circuit court level. If there is an indication that somebody is a particular danger to another individual, you can go to the circuit court and receive a personal injunction against that person.
Like a marital dispute or even just a dispute with anybody where they get potentially violent.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Aha. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, that can be very busy then, and a lot of emotions will run high there. Apparently, misdemeanor cases, of course, but that's where a misdemeanor is sort of like a minor criminal case, I guess, and some of the examples here from the City of Dearborn website, shoplifting, assault and battery, possession of firearms, I guess without a license, or inappropriate firearms and inappropriate places. Minor drug violations, I assume they'd be possession of small amounts of regulated substances. Yeah. Drunk driving and reckless driving, but those are misdemeanor cases. That's not a matter of traffic.
Well, or sometimes the drunk driving, of course, are traffic, but they're traffic misdemeanor cases. A misdemeanor case generally can be defined as a case where the maximum penalty does not exceed 1 year in jail. Anything that may involve a year and a day or more would be either a high misdemeanor or a felony case.
Well, that's a relief. Oh, sorry.
on the other hand, describing things as, quote, minor criminal offenses is sort of like describing having minor surgery.
Sure.
If you're the one that's having the surgery performed on you, it doesn't feel too minor. Yeah. And there are serious consequences that can follow a quote-unquote misdemeanor conviction. It can affect your ability to obtain student loans. Yeah. If you have to fill out that FAFSA form and check the box that says I have a criminal misdemeanor drug possession charge, you may place your ability to get a student loan in jeopardy. You may not get a job.
Yeah, certain jobs ask questions about that, too. Even misdemeanor, not just felony,
correct.
But misdemeanor.
Uh-huh. And if they involve theft or dishonesty or drugs, and if you're not a citizen, you can lose your ability to stay in the country.
Now, Judge, when you and I, not when we first met, but when we met on campus, one of the things you said, and I asked you, you know, you're making this move or you're planning this move in hopes of going to the circuit court, and you said, it seems like the right time. You said, and I hope I get the age right, you said, I'm 53 years old. Is that accurate?
Almost 54.
Almost 54. You said, I feel like I'm young enough, I have the energy, and you talked to your family, and you said that this is a good time to make this move. And that, could you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. Prior to taking the bench a little over 9 years ago, I practiced law for 19 years, so I've been at it almost 29 years in the legal business. I thoroughly enjoy and love what I do at the district court, and if I was told that I was to be there for another 20 years, I would be a very content person, honestly. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of good things, and there are more things I could talk about the special programs we run. But looking at it in terms of a lifetime career, if ever I was to think about making a move to a higher court, it makes sense in terms of my age, my experience. I think with almost 29 years of law, 9 on the bench, I think I'm more than well qualified to handle the circuit court level. Most of my 19 years of individual practice was frankly at the circuit court level, so I'm very familiar with the ins and outs there. And I happen to be in the middle of a term, so it's a good time to run. I don't have to resign my seat at the district court in order to run for the circuit court.
Your term would continue to 2014, technically. Yeah.
And I think I can take the same judicial philosophy to the next level, which is very simple.
Well, what's the difference between the courts then? It seems to me then that the circuit court compared to district court that you're in now, the cases are more serious crimes.
Again, I always hesitate to call something more or less serious.
Okay.
Certainly, there's a level of criminal activity that takes you into possible incarceration in the Department of Corrections.
But they're not doing parking tickets.
No, they're not doing, and you're not talking about going to jail for 90 days. You're talking about years or even life. So certainly on the criminal end of things, it's more serious in the terms of the punitive consequences that are possible. Assignment on the circuit court level, though, would be either to criminal court down at Frank Murphy Hall of Justice, the Juvenile Justice Court on East Forest, which deals with juveniles countywide. It would be to the KMAC building for either civil case or family law type cases. And you get specialized into a specific area instead of the broad general jurisdiction that we handle.
But I just read somewhere, it's not divorce. That's a separate court.
Oh, no, that's...
Divorces are part of the district.
It's one of the divisions.
I mean, part of the
circuit
courts.
Correct.
Okay. Because Dennis made a question here, because Dennis is now also a reporter with the Press and Guide newspaper here in Dearborn for Dearborn Heights. He just recently took over the Dearborn Heights beat. And as long as they don't beat him up too much over there.
I'm faster than any of those.
But you found out that there was it the governor that appointed?
Margaret Van Houten
yes.
to the 3rd District Criminal Division. And she, in fact, I think she's succeeding Mary Beth Kelly.
Mary Beth Kelly was not in the criminal division. She was in the civil division.
Okay.
In fact, was chief judge. Of course, we all know she became a Michigan Supreme Court justice.
Right.
And they hadn't filled her seat. So.
And she's actually in the courtroom that Justice Zara was in prior to
being. Frank Murphy.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So that my question was, is that a seat that is no longer available?
Or will it come up for election for the regular term in this year?
My understanding is she will have to run later this year.
Uh-huh.
That would be the 4th seat. There are three open ones.
That's what, three.
And they'll be on a separate part of the ballot. If I understand correctly, I believe she'll be with the, quote-unquote, the pack, you know, vote for 18 of the following candidates type category.
Okay.
And the seats that I'm putting my name in for are three open seats.
Gotcha.
They'll be listed separately, non-incumbent positions.
Okay. And these are nonpartisan listings.
Yes,
so,
please,
yes.
When you vote, flip past the partisan part
can't
of the
ballot.
Can't
just do the straight party necessarily, although
if you vote
not many people
party,
do
you
straight party anymore, but you don't get to the good stuff. And there may be some, especially in November, some ballot proposals, too, statewide.
Absolutely.
That may be important to, and we don't know about locally. Locally, probably not in Dearborn. I haven't heard a thing that's going to be on the ballot from Dearborn as a proposal, but certainly statewide, there's more than a half dozen petitions that are still circulating. Nothing has been certified yet, so it's going to be an important time. So you will be campaigning towards November then.
August.
Okay, I was going to say that we know that there is for some offices, of course, the primary.
Right.
So.
Right. August 7th is a primary.
August 7th.
I would be surprised if there were not enough candidates for the open seats to have a primary vote. It's very unusual to have three open non-incumbent positions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware of it, at least three assistant Wayne County prosecutors who are collecting signatures. One of our own magistrates at the 19th District Court, Adele Harb, is running also. I know he's collecting signatures. And I believe former Attorney General Mike Cox's brother, and I believe one other that I'm aware of, attorney, last name is Braxton. I'm not familiar with her, so
mm-hmm.
We'll get more than six, I think.
Yeah.
Typically for this level of court, now, so we, certainly for the Supreme Court, even though that's supposedly nonpartisan, we know the Democratic Party has its people that are recommended and the Republicans have their people recommended. There's really no party endorsements per se or slate or anything that for the circuit court.
No, in fact, that's one of the great ironies in our system. We are told not to promote a party affiliation in support of our candidacy as mm-hmm. as a nonpartisan judicial candidate, and yet the Supreme Court justices, as you indicate, are actually nominated at a party convention.
And it's got to make them feel somewhat beholden to, and maybe they already had similar political views, but then that makes them an activist judge, doesn't it, if they act on them that way. Whatever that, I'll ask you about that in a second. But,
okay.
But
you
you're absolutely right. I mean, I can understand maybe getting support from one side or the other if they were appointed for life or elected for life or something. But when they have to continue running for re-election, that costs money, and you know about that too. But it's really unfortunate in our system that candidates have to eat a lot of rubber chicken or whatever it is to raise money. Although your campaigns, I met you many years ago, Mark, at my doorstep, at my home in Dearborn, that you and your wife, Jenny, have done an awful lot of door-to-door for your two campaigns, and even before that, of course, I think you tried once before for elections. So you've been around and shaking hands and meeting the public in Dearborn for almost two decades, and, I mean, directed towards this position you're in now, too.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And if the county wasn't so darn big, we'd do it countywide.
That was my question.
But the next best thing in this process, collecting the signatures, has been, by and large, myself, my wife, my son, with some very valuable support from some friends, but we have, just as a family, collected over 3,000 of the signatures ourselves.
And great.
In that course, we've probably met 15,000 people, I'd guess. But
mm-hmm. And you needed 4,000?
Right.
Okay.
We're over the 4,000.
Yeah, I think your goal, you said, was around 6?
Yeah, we'll keep going.
I usually sign almost anybody's petition. And somewhere someone on campus got me, had a petition of yours for me to sign, and he said he was a cousin of yours. So you must have a good-sized family. Everything
we're not,
helps.
We're not that big.
Yeah.
But we're just energetic.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds like the next big challenge. I was going to ask a general question, but let's go back to the last challenge. Everybody knows we're talking to Judge Mark Summers, 19th District Court judge here in Dearborn. And people that follow the show and follow the newspapers, they know that a couple of cases have come up in court, legal suits, about decisions you made in terms of administering the Dearborn courts and personnel in particular. And right now, I'm looking at last Sunday's Press and Guide. They make a big deal about the $1.2 million that somebody may have to pay. And I say may have to because, if you indicated earlier to me, there's still some appeals going on.
Right.
But that's got to really hurt. I mean, I haven't been at your court. I haven't looked at your individual decisions, but I followed the stories about your court in the paper and the positive initiatives you mentioned that you began when you were appointed by the state of Michigan to be the chief administrator. And all those initiatives seemed totally appropriate to me. And I read both sides of the argument for the cases in the paper, which is always summarized, never the whole story, I know.
There's not enough room.
No, there's never enough room for all the ins and outs. But it seemed to me there wasn't grounds enough to have this ruling. Now, let me get one thing straight. This was a jury of somebody's peers that made both these decisions, or some of the decisions along the way were made by a single judge, but right?
Well, there are always pretrial rulings leading up to the trial in terms of what evidence can come in, what evidence cannot come in. There are rulings during a trial as well, and it would take us a lifetime of shows to go back through all of that.
I know. I'm not asking for that
but
now.
Yes, but it hurts. It stings. The particular one that you're talking about involved the would-be court administrator who was in a relationship, domestic relationship, with one of my fellow judges.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an intention at the time, prior to me being the chief judge, to have her move into the chief administrator's slot. And I objected to that and thought it violated at least the spirit of our anti-nepotism policy, if not the, mm-hmm. the letter of it.
Sort of a conflict of interest in a way, but nepotism meaning she would get special favors.
And
but
the Supreme Court agreed and said, no, you can't have it. Mm. And ultimately, in looking at our personnel makeup, our structure, I decided that we really didn't need the position she had.
Yeah.
I actually did the math. I figured we had spent $240,000+ on a position we didn't need over the years. And at the end of the day, in a courtroom with a jury, they decided that my elimination of her position was retaliatory, and they awarded the judgment.
As you know, you obviously respect the courts, or you wouldn't be in the court system yourself. Things can happen in a jury trial, and I can just add my opinion here that from the lawyers I've talked to, there seems to be, especially with a jury who's not, they're not legal professionals, but they're supposedly similar to the people that are under or being tried or bringing a case to them. So they actually weren't a jury of your peers, right? They were a jury of her peers because they weren't all lawyers on the jury, right?
I'm going to give them a lot more credit than that.
Okay.
Fellow citizens.
Okay. But I'm saying that the bias seems to be, and maybe it's just a law school joke or something, that the juries would generally, even forget about the facts, that they would emotionally side with the underdog, the person who was not part of the system.
Oh, I would.
You know, I mean, that doesn't mean it happened in this case. You disagree that that's not a basic rule.
Oh, no, I would not disagree with you at all.
Oh, you wouldn't disagree.
I would not disagree with you.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, there is, in movies and television, that's always the spirit of the underdog, you know, against the big corporation
or the
political person at the top of the system or the establishment. You know, the anti-establishment feeling is a powerful emotional appeal. I saw a couple cases, had nothing to do with your situation, about Henry Ford Community College, and actually said in the trials, and I couldn't believe the judgments that the jury finally came to. Again, I don't know the ins and outs of applying the laws, but I don't think anybody in the jury knew any better than I did, because I was there listening to the judge's directions and reading the nature of the laws and that, and it sometimes is quite amazing where juries come down or how they come to their decisions. Obviously, that's a good part of our system. They apply our laws and our rules to the whole situation, you know, the emotional situation as well as the political, social, whatever. And you know, they try to be fair, but it seems to me in civil cases like these, they would side with the underdog typically, and wow, any sort of innuendo might be overblown. I'm not saying that's what happened, but I'm saying that, you know, they always see on television, in fact, the lawyer is always saying, so you really did sleep with her. You're out of order. Okay, jury is told to disregard this. Well, of course, they heard it. They're thinking about it. So legally, they can't officially say that as they make their ruling, but They can still vote however they want. It's a complicated, it's a human process. There's a human dynamic always, and sometimes it doesn't work out how you might expect. And I feel sorry for it, because I know that you are very well intentioned in everything you've tried to do for the courts. And this is, well, I don't know. As I said, maybe we'll cover later in the hour. We're not going to ask you to stay too much longer, because you probably got to get back to your work. But there is the whole wrangling going on, as the depressing guide talks about that, who's going to be paying the $1.2 million ruling. Personally, and I can express my opinion here, I don't see how or why you should be paying it yourself personally. I bet you agree. Don't just say anything. But, I mean, I'm just saying it because, well, the two main facts is, who appointed you chief administrator? The state did, right?
Well, that's part of the argument that the city. The city makes the argument that since I'm a state employee, the state should pay. Mm-hmm. But there are a few decisions that have been made along those lines by appellate courts that I believe very firmly come down on the side of the court's policy here. Mm-hmm. And courts don't generate money that they keep. Anything that the court takes in is turned over to our, quote, funding unit. In this case, this district court is funded by the city of Dearborn.
So the police department keeps the cash they confiscate.
Well, it goes into the general fund.
Well, for them.
Right, and then they are responsible to support our reasonable and necessary operating expenses. Uh-huh. And there's some very solid appellate law that says that just as a funding unit benefits from the wise administration by the courts, if it's unwise, then they still have to pay the cost. And I don't think my decision was unwise, and I want to be careful there.
No, well.
But where things go bad, then the funding unit is equally responsible, just as when things go well. We save money, they benefit. We lose money over something like this, and it's covered. I would ask a sort of a rhetorical question. What judge in their right mind would ever want to be a chief judge if they knew that they could be individually responsible or liable for making an administrative decision? Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, all three judges at our court certainly are on the same side of that, including the judge whose fiancé is the one who brought the suit.
Right.
And I'm not, of course, he has a self-interest, I have a self-interest, but as judges, we recognize that who would ever want that job?
Yeah. Two things along that line. One is it specifically, just like I would assume some psychologist in their practice or psychoanalyst, that after a dozen or two dozen years, that all they see is sick people. Sort of the problem for any doctor, I guess. And all you see is people who might be criminals or liable for some damages. Is that sometimes frustrating and bring you down, or do you feel happy when people can be proven innocent and and you can help get appropriate restitution for some things that have happened?
Sure. I have a very simple judicial philosophy, and that is that we should be problem solvers. Hmm. The day I get up and I don't want to solve a problem, I should just stay home, just pull the covers back over my head and not go to work and give somebody else the job. And I mean it seriously. The last 6 years I've run the drug treatment court at the 19th District Court.
I was going to bring that up.
Judge Sabaka started it. God bless her. It's a great program, and it focuses on getting people with substance abuse issues into treatment and getting clean, staying out of jail, working, being with their families. If you look at the big picture at the circuit court level, if somebody's sent to prison, it's close to $35,000 a year to imprison them. For us at the local level, if we send somebody to a county jail, it's $35 to $40 a night. Hmm. If you put an addict in jail, you get an addict back if they're not treated. So we focus on the treatment aspect. And so I kind of take a holistic approach to what I do. So I don't get down when I see crime after crime or alleged crime after alleged crime. I look at it as an opportunity to help those who need help, certainly to punish those who are deserving of punishment. There's a balance to every day.
Sort of, I've been a teacher here at the college for 40 years full-time, and now I've been, after retiring a couple of years ago, just with WHFR. I know some of my colleagues who haven't lasted as long. I have to go back in that classroom. The kids don't know anything. Of course, they don't say kids, let's say the students. But and of course, that's always true. Every new semester, people are coming there because they want to know. Well, I hope they do. And it's our job to find a way. So I see it as a creative challenge to find the best way that they can grow and develop. But it is always, it always seems in a way sort of a setback. Is it, we're back to zero again. We're back to the entry level, you know. But to see people or things improve, to see the positive outcomes of what you do, that compensates for any sort of stress or other things, or at least it did for me anyway. And I know that the, I was going to ask, but I think your answer is that you're making progress. Is the so-called war on drugs working or not? Is it just going to be a continuing problem for our society with all new kinds of designer drugs always coming out too?
I really wish I had the answer to that. I know mm-hmm. that there's a whole lot more that we could be doing and that we are not doing. I'm more than satisfied that whether you are interested in rehabilitating somebody and treating them because of just compassion, or if you're interested in saving money, your interests come together in the judicial system. And when funding units, legislators come to realize the kind of money that we can save by dealing at the human level with the individual, we are able to take steps, giant steps forward. The whole concept of problem-solving courts is really gaining traction, not only in Michigan, but across the nation. We just had in February the, 11th annual Michigan Association of Drug Court Professionals Convention in Lansing. We had over 600 people last year, I believe more than that this year. It is law enforcement, judges, social workers, probation officers coming together. And you can very easily demonstrate that you spend a dollar on a treatment-oriented program, you're going to save $5 or $6 in other costs. And I would argue that you should take that even further and start taking care of women when they're pregnant, so that you have healthy children. If we don't get a societal interest that starts at that point, we are doomed to spend time, money, and have tragedies that are avoidable.
Yeah, and if the court system has the jurisdiction to be involved in these positive ways in these programs, I think they should. I don't see that as the so-called political activism. I see it as positive social activism. I mean, every branch of government should be doing positive social activism. That's why you're elected. That's why you're serving. To think of the courts as, well, we just punish them. You know, we lock them up. We make them feel really bad, you know. Well, no, because they're just going to come back at you. It's like most of our prisons are still revolving doors, that they're not a great rehabilitation facility. You know, that's not what our prisons primarily do, unfortunately. I commend you on working with the drug program, continuing that and doing what you can. There's a much marijuana conviction problems? Or
there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
And you know, I know I strayed you a little bit from the war on drugs topic.
Yeah, but
from the judge's perspective, I often tell people, look, I don't get to pick laws I like and laws I don't like.
Yeah.
I raise my hand and I take an oath to preserve and protect the Constitution and the laws of the nation and of the state. So I don't get to pick and choose, because if I did, we have over 600 judges just in the state of Michigan and we'd have 600 sets of laws.
Hmm.
We still see a lot of marijuana charges in the courts, even with the Medical Marijuana Act coming in and a lot of people taking advantage of what it offers. But that's a whole other subject.
Yeah, we can't talk about that today.
The federal and state law are at loggerheads there.
Yeah. The DJ coming up at 2 o'clock, Joanne, our blues DJ, she just made a visit to the district court, 19th District Court, Wednesday, about talking about a parking ticket issue. And I was wondering if you could help her. No. It's already been adjudicated.
Yeah,
the question.
You just go down Greenfield, you make a left on Michigan, and the courthouse is on the right.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
But it's,
she appreciates it.
There was some decision made, and I thought she had a great argument that she could make. But the issue was she was seeing a magistrate, and she thought she would see a judge. So how many magistrates are there? How is a magistrate different, or the caseload different than, let's say, your cases?
Sure. District courts may, if they wish, appoint magistrates to assist the judges with some of the docket. What we have chosen to do is to have the magistrates have control over the initial informal hearings on civil infraction cases, speeding tickets, parking tickets, and so forth. They also mm-hmm. would hear initial hearings on small claims, civil cases where someone's suing for up to $3,500 without a lawyer being involved. Their proceedings are not recorded. They are not a court of record in that sense. Anyone who feels aggrieved by a decision of a magistrate has the right to appeal the decision within 7 days to one of the district judges, and it will be randomly assigned to
us. I'll tell her that today.
So, but it's a 7-day limit, so you got to get
in there
and appeal. The city can also appeal those. And I've had a couple of those where the citizen won in front of a magistrate and the city appealed to the judge.
So how many magistrates do we have right now?
We have 3 part-time magistrates. In total, they serve us 1.5 days a week, so 3 mm-hmm. half days.
Okay. Interesting. And one of the, Judge Wygonek, who is one of the 3 in the district court right now, his term is expiring, and he's up for re-election.
This year.
Or competition from a couple other. One of the people running is former magistrate Salami?
Correct.
I'm sorry,
right.
Salami.
Right, Sam Salami.
Sam Salami. But he's not currently a magistrate.
No.
Okay. Well, interesting. And something came up just in some emails. I just want to clarify. When you first ran, or maybe in 2008 even, you had the endorsement of Mayor O'Reilly?
I did.
Yeah. And apparently he has Mayor O'Reilly's endorsement.
Correct.
For this fall. I don't quite understand that, but, well, good for him for getting an endorsement, you know.
I haven't talked to either one of them about
yeah.
it.
I've seen Judge Wygonek around, and he seems to be very active, and I trust you're giving him whatever help you can in terms of being the chief administrator. He hasn't done that before, has he?
No. I had the position for 6 years, which is a little unusual, actually. They're 2-year terms. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps Judge Sabaka had it for 6 years before, but she may be the only
other. Do they give you extra money or reduced load for doing that?
Well, no extra money. Technically, the chief judge may assign themselves fewer cases in light of their administrative duties. I never did. In fact, I think if you look at the caseloads, I've always been at the top.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I thank you for all of your service in these years. The last question was that had come to me, and I'm sorry I should have written these down, but I went to a conference this morning and I got sort of behind in my prep. But tough judge. Are you a tough judge? Some people said, he really gives those rulings.
He's a hanging judge.
But I assume that's because they were found guilty of something.
Yes, sour grapes.
I mean, it's always hard to judge, but do you feel that you're, I assume you think that the punishments that you assign are appropriate for the situation, but...
Of course I do, or I wouldn't do it. I don't go into work intentionally thinking I'm going to be over the top on somebody. If you want to use the word tough, I'll take it.
Elect you to anything if you're, say, for I believe the Republican candidates for Supreme Court, that was their campaign. Yeah. We're tough. We're tough, tough, tough on crime. And the Democratic people for Supreme Court were just saying, we're good judges. And that. And of course, there were a number of Republicans elected at the same time. So.
Right.
It just wasn't a Republican sweep, perhaps. But I'm just saying tough is either good or bad, depending on how you look at it,
well,
I guess.
Well, I like to think that I take my job seriously.
Okay.
I take my job as an obligation to try to solve problems. And again, it's a holistic approach, in my view. If you're going to use the word tough, I'll take that. If you hurt a vulnerable person, I'm probably not the judge that you're going to want to see. On the other hand, I think tough love is on the other end of that spectrum, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel an obligation to try to help somebody have a better outcome for their life at the end of the day. And that's why I'm involved so much with the drug court, and I'm a real believer in probation. I believe in rehabilitation. I believe in second chances. I think if you surveyed and asked the city attorney's office, you would find that I give more youthful offenders, what we call youthful trainee status, and I'll give it multiple times. I hope they're not all listening. I won't bounce somebody in jail on the first time they violate probation. I'll work with them. And I'll do it with the idea that it is in their own interest to work towards a better result at the end of the day. So, yeah, I spend a lot more time, put a lot more people on probation, spend a lot more time reviewing cases, a lot more time having people come in front of me on a violation. But at the end of the day, I look at it as a learning process for them.
Well, it's a tough job to do, much less in terms of making those decisions about how really to straighten problems out. I think you're exactly right in that approach, is that that's really what the primary purpose of the courts has to be, to do the right thing, to justice. You follow the laws, of course, but you have to do what you can for the people on both sides of the issues that come before you. So we've been talking a long time. We'll let him go now. Judge Mark Summers, who is a candidate for the Third Circuit Court, and will be on we'll be on a ballot in August 7th, which in this case comes after Dearborn Homecoming weekend, so we'll see you around Dearborn Homecoming, I bet.
You know I'm going to be there.
Okay. Well, thank you very, very much. I'm glad that we see you here and not in court.
Although, I really would encourage anyone who hasn't been to the district court to come down and watch. Friday morning is a particularly great morning to come in. See what's going on in your community. The papers don't have the time and the ink to tell you the whole story.
And it's not like television at all. No. It's not like the TV cases, believe me, folks. I was just down the big court in downtown Detroit, whatever, and I was picked for a jury for a serious crime. And what's amazing is even just the trying to choose the people on the jury. The process is so intensely fair. I mean, the questioning, and of course, people get a chance to be, both attorneys get to choose those they think will be favorable to their case. But the judges' rulings, they're just, the laws are extremely complex. But I think you will revel in the fairness of the whole process. Although I have to say, a few lawyers I've seen, defense attorneys, are not up to the Perry Mason standard. I mean, they're just
really
just. But that's the reality of the fact. Yeah. You know, is that all the judges I've seen, both in the district courts here, and I was not in one of your courts, but one of the other judges' courts a couple of years ago, just as an observer, and then as on juries in look that one up when he's out of here.
Yeah.
But seriously, the judges are and I'm sure you too have to be just so knowledgeable, so prepared in order to keep the cases on an even keel. It's an amazingly complicated task, and I hope people do take a visit down. I think sometimes you have like school groups that come down. But
anybody's welcome anytime. If somebody wants to organize a group for a particular reason, if they're a little younger and more sensitive age, we might want to talk about which proceedings would be suitable for them.
Let them chew gum, but not text.
Probably not. Yeah. No, you can't take the phone into the courthouse.
Right, that's okay. Remember that. Okay.
Leave the phones outside.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Judge Mark Summers, running for now Circuit Court in Dearborn and District Court right now. Thank you so much for your service and your time today. We appreciate
it. My pleasure. Anytime.
We're going to listen to some Jim Hightower commentaries now and be back with more Journal.
No bids for James Q. Wilson, who recently died, were glowing. This arch-conservative sociologist had developed the broken windows theory of crime, which was embraced by such tough guy prosecutors as Rudy Giuliani. Unmentioned in all of the elegies, however, was the curious fact that Wilson had a soft spot for certain kinds of criminals. His controversial theory was that tolerating broken windows in a neighborhood's vacant buildings creates an escalating crime problem. Street criminals, he argued, see such dilapidation as a sign that community standards are low, convincing them that more serious crimes would be tolerated there. The key to stopping big crime, he concluded, was to crack down on the little things, targeting beggars, petty thieves, and prostitutes. But if this theory deters crime in the streets, what about crime in the suites? Bill Black, a noted expert on financial fraud, points out on the New Economic Perspectives blog that Wilson was willfully blind to the economically crushing crimes of white-collar elites. Black quotes Wilson dismissively declaring that, quote, street crime is a far more serious matter than consumer fraud or antitrust violations. I am rather tolerant of some forms of civic corruption, Wilson writes, adding parenthetically that if a good mayor can stay in office and govern effectively only by making a few deals with highway contractors, I don't get overly alarmed. This is Jim Hightower saying, oh, great, this crime theorist taught a whole generation of prosecutors to be aggressive about broken windows in poor neighborhoods. but wink at the broken ethics of corporate, financial, and political elites. This class bias by authorities is precisely what allowed Wall Street to break our economy, a Wilson legacy that continues today. To read Bill Black's full posting, go to neweconomicperspectives.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Another way that the rich are different from you and me is that their bankers serve freshly baked chocolate chip cookies to them. The uber-rich, of course, are used to such coddling. But now, a class of customers that bankers have dubbed the mass affluent get cookies, too. Think you might qualify? You do, if you have a minimum of $500,000 to open one of these mass affluent accounts. Otherwise, you fall into a category called lower margin customers. So go get in the ATM line, bucko. This $500,000 and up bunch are not the 1%ers, but they are 10%ers. And they've suddenly become hotly coveted by J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America, and other big chain banks. To reel in these mid-level richies, bankers are offering to pamper them lavishly. For example, rather than having to breathe the same air as the riffraff, they get to bank in cushy private lounges. The carpets are plush, the cookies fresh, and a nice touch of wine and cheese might be available. There are no lines and no tellers to deal with. Instead, these affluent swells get relationship managers who cater to their banking needs, including being available after hours. And here's something completely astonishing. One bank president says of her advantaged clients, "We'll come to you. If you want us to meet you in your home on a Sunday, we'll do that." This is Jim Hightower saying the chain bankers are opening hundreds of these posh new banking nests for the affluent in upscale neighborhoods across the country. Even as they are feverishly inventing new fees and coldly shrinking services for you and me. It's another move by the powers that be to wall off the good fortunes of the privileged few from even having to be in the same room as America's unaffluent majority. Indeed, they're creating their own exclusive America.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
This is Jay and Dennis, and we are back with more of the new WHFR Journal for Friday, March 30th. Still one more day in the month. Which months have 31 days? You remember that old slogan?
How do you remember it? Because I just use my knuckles. Have you ever done that?
I open my calendar. That's I'm sorry, I cheat. But
so high tech.
Yeah, 30 days has November, April, June, and September.
Use your knuckles.
Okay.
That's the easy way.
All right.
What do you got?
Well, I'm looking at just really quickly going to go through a couple of the papers here. If you want more information about the current situation, about who should pay the $1.2 million in the Judge Summers civil case rulings, that's a great summary article written by J. Patrick Pepper in last Sunday's Press and Guide. Of course, you can go to their website, pressandguide.com, too, and read about that. But there's so many ins and outs of that that, again, we can't discuss that here. I thought it was interesting in terms of letters to the editor, editorial opinions, a Peter Blohm, and this is Peter, P-E-D-E-R, Blohm, B-L-O-H-M, is also in last Sunday's Press and Guide. He has an extended editorial opinion, which is headlined, "Is Dearborn Its Biggest Enemy?" And that's controversial right there. And he does. He attacks Mayor Jack O'Reilly, saying things that are not favorable about him. And he says that here in Dearborn, we don't really have a complete view of who and what our mission is all about, who we are and what our mission should be in terms of other cities nearby and you might say city planning issues and promotional issues. So he thinks basically we're doing it wrong. But all the questions he raises about, what we should figure out, who are our competing cities, what will it take for Dearborn to be the winner of the future, how do we position ourselves, I have to say, Peter, that I think Mayor O'Reilly and all of his elected officials, or most of them that I've talked to, are actively trying to answer those questions. I think those questions are ongoing. I don't think there's any ultimate answer
Absolutely.
That anybody can have at any point in time. But I think they're really working hard on all of these things, And I don't think we are our own worst enemy. Other than maybe writing a column like this, I'm sorry. No, you have the right to do that, and it's good to have so much detail about where our thoughts should be and decisions we should make. Obviously, you disagree about the job that Mayor Jack O'Reilly has done, and people should read the details of that. That's your opinion, but you express yourself well, and I commend you for taking the time to do that.
I just think that some of the things that are quote unquote wrong with the city are that's the completely wrong word to use, actually. But some of the things that are maybe slowing down the city have nothing to do with actual city government. And I know that there's landlords out there that have pretty good space available for businesses, and they're and this is directly from the business owners' mouths. They may not be willing to negotiate a lower rate. They'd rather have the property sit empty. The city government can't compel them to rent it at a lower rate. So, I mean, is Dearborn its own worst enemy? If you include some of the residents and some of the property owners, maybe you have more of a case.
And he does have an individual situation, too, that probably his general opinions about the city and its current government goes from. He says, I have personally, this is, again, Peter Blome, I have personally gone through a situation where it took 7 months and a huge loss of revenue before getting a certificate of occupancy. Ask any business that opens up if it was easy and if the city was helping moving in and starting up. Ask any contractor, ask any homeowner. I strongly believe that the city of Dearborn is its own biggest enemy. And I think he's talking about, again, the building and safety departments. Right now we have two of them, and it seems they're going through another reorganization for whatever reasons. And that's been a problem for years. Whether or not it's that specific problem that he had or other things. And I know he says Mayor O'Reilly is not being a good listener, talking a good talk, but doesn't take suggestions or input from anyone. He's obviously frustrated, but I don't see that as being the case. O'Reilly taking plenty of input and responding to it and working on it. Yes, he has strong opinions. He's got programs in mind, and he knows a lot. And he'll be on our show, a special edition during our Pledge Week on Tuesday, April 24th, from 1 to 2 o'clock, and instead of the Friday show. But it'll be podcast also, folks, if you can't tune in on Tuesday. But that was when he was available, and that's just a couple weeks from now, about 2 weeks from next Tuesday, I believe. We'll have Mayor John B. O'Reilly, Jr., the whole hour. And
Three weeks from next Tuesday.
Okay, yeah. April, not quite April yet.
No, April 24th, right. Yeah.
3 weeks from next Tuesday. And so we'll definitely see if he listens to us.
Well, no, that's good. And I know that you've done this. If people have questions, I know you've extended the opportunity to get emails to you with specific, intelligent questions, you know.
Well, yeah. And any questions that you want to submit to me for review and possible asking of the mayor, by all means, anytime, whfr@hfcc.edu and put down journal or Dear Jay or whatever, just so they know to forward it to me right away. We have one person reviewing all of our email, which is hundreds of emails a day we get on different topics, and we have many different officers, and that person forwards them quickly each day to whoever is responsible. So again, the email address for the journal is just simply whfr@hfcc.edu. And sure, we're going to bring up, of course, a list of questions of our own, for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Craig Ferrand also has a part of a three-part series on right to work or collective bargaining. And, of course, right to work is one of those horrible misnomers. Right to work doesn't have anything to do with the real issues that people would like to say it is. There's no law that says you can't work. Everybody has a right to work in Michigan if you qualify and you get hired, okay? The idea, if you don't be forced into being a union person, and if you don't want that, then you can't get hired. Well, yeah, you can. There are ways you can still not be a union member, but I think you still have to pay the union dues. But there's reasons for that, and it's not easy to explain here. I've tried briefly to talk about very briefly, too briefly, about the history of unions in America and what they've done for us and what they still need to do for us. But he's not doing a pro-union thing. He's doing three whole parts. This is like in-depth investigative and or opinion-related reporting, and good for the Press and Guide in letting Craig start this. The first part was this last Sunday. The next part is going to be, March 28th. Oh, it's in the Wednesday edition. Mm-hmm. Okay, I got to read that. I haven't read it yet.
It's a three consecutive
issue. And the third part will be April 1st, which is the Sunday edition
right, coming
up. So all this week, and again, you can go to their website. Hopefully that three-part series is there. He's doing a good job with that. And again, many points of view there, and it's good to follow that. I think, and I'm just going to look briefly at the other two papers here. Nothing I circled in that one. Press and Guide. One thing I didn't get to, that was Wednesday night, that's when we have our WHFR meetings, is the WDET came to Dearborn and actually had opinions, or listening to opinions. They weren't broadcasting it. They were just listening to community opinions to get ideas for, I don't know, future shows or news articles that they're going to do. And the Craig Folly from the Craig Folly Show, which is Monday through Friday mornings and also repeated in the evenings on WDET, that's 101.9, folks, non-commercial, National Public Radio, but fantastic local news job they do. I listen to Craig Folly Show almost every morning. And they got a great picture there of one of the WDET people talking or at the table right next to one of our WHFR staff members, a significant person in the community for many years, Margaret King Ahmed. They don't give her name there.
No, they didn't. That's interesting.
Don't they usually give credit to the people in the picture?
Sure.
Okay. And and she was part of that forum too, and that's great. Certainly, they have many more staff and a much bigger budget than WHFR, so they can get out and about. And I commend Craig Folly and all of their news team for actually getting involved with the community. And in terms of local radio news, they do the best job. Yes, even better than WWJ in terms of, certainly in terms of Dearborn, anyway. Okay, I wanted to spend the remaining time. It's only about 5 minutes. Okay. I was at, and shame you if you were not at it, Renewing Michigan. It is the fifth annual Alternative Energy Summit. It's just concluded about an hour ago here at the HFCC campus. Parking lot was half empty.
Or half full.
And I counted only 60 people at the keynote address. In an auditorium that holds 400.
Ouch.
So I hope more people came a little later than 8:30. It started at 8:30. Well, a little after that, but and they had, who was there? Well, at the beginning, we heard an in-person presentation from Congressman John Dingell.
Cool.
And, of course, Mayor O'Reilly was there. On video, we had about a 5-6 minute video from Senator Debbie Stabenow.
That's pretty cool.
They have a facility in Washington, D.C. It's already set up with a flag and capital in the background. It's a fake thing,
was it live?
No, it wasn't live.
Okay.
But I mean, they just taped it and somehow sent the file to us.
I'm familiar with the type, but sometimes they have those things where she'll be there and you can talk to her and interact.
No,
on a conference call.
No, it wasn't that. No.
Okay.
As I said, she was not live at that moment, but that was nice for her to do. It's election year for her, too, I think. So, and Matt Rausch, who is the Great Lakes IT report author, which is an internet sort of blog newsletter thing, but he's also on WWJ News Radio. And of course, IT report means, what sort of computer-based technology is going on in Michigan? He's expanded his IT report to include all the latest alternative energy initiatives, too, which is usually technology-based.
Sure.
Wind, solar, everything needs technology to create it and to keep it running even. So what I did was, and all of them had great comments, I got to the presentation by two people from the city of Dearborn, Liz Hendley and Jessica Turner, who one or the other we might have on this show in the future. When we talk about a non-motorized transportation plan for a city, it's the overview of the report, as Dave Norwood said last week on this show, it's basically called Complete Streets.
Right.
Complete Streets. And a lot of communities are being encouraged to have such a plan and to begin making pardon the non-motorized cliche here, baby steps towards the goal of allowing people to get around in their communities to the things that they need, that they can walk or bike easily to these places. And, you know, a lot of parts of Dearborn, especially in the middle of Dearborn, are not designed that way at all. I mean, there's no way for pedestrians or bicyclists to easily and safely travel to and from Fairlane or to Henry Ford Community College or U of M Dearborn in this area. You know, I've done it. It's risky. Yeah, we need bike lanes identified. We need signage. We need new construction. You know, the roads may need to be redirected and rebuilt to accommodate safety. In fact, even today, it was interesting. You know, I've railed for years about the huge incline on the bike path that goes behind U of MD but continues up to Michigan Avenue. Right at Michigan Avenue, boy, it comes up. If you're going up,
yep,
or if you're coming down, it's about a 40-degree angle. Yep. I mean, it is steep. I've seen seniors, impossible for them, even with a multi-speed bike, to pedal up that 40-degree angle.
Right, they have to get off and walk it, sure.
Yeah, and one of these two people from the city of Dearborn said, yeah, that's not even safe. That kind of angle, that kind of steep angle is not even safe. So I'm thinking, why did the federal grant and the people that planned it years ago even allow that to happen? You know, well, they would have had to bring in, I guess, 4 billion tons of dirt to level that out there. But I'm just saying,
well, the standards might have been different too.
Yeah, nobody went into this LEED lead standard for neighborhood development. There is going to be a big community workshop on April 26th. During our pledge week in West Dearborn, in terms of the design of the community around the new intermodal train station.
And they're working on that right now. Did you see that?
They're getting started on that. But the design, they want community input in terms of not just landscaping, but the way the roads and the sidewalks and the cars will all move through there easily or not. It's very, very important that you give them that input. And they're making good progress although I still think it's going to take years before we can ever get good transportation or connection between East and West Dearborn and in and around the center part of the city here, where Henry Ford Community College is. But it was a great conference. And we had people, as I tried to say, I thought everybody in the community would want to come out because they had a representative from Eastern Market talking about urban farming. Mm-hmm. And they had people talking about improvements in your home and your home landscaping. And so most of the stuff was not just about business and industry, but how you can, you know, change your mind, change your lifestyle, and actually, in the long run, save money. I couldn't make it to all the sessions, even. They had, get this, Dennis can see it from a distance.
Yes.
5 sessions each 45-minute period. And there's 3 periods. So there was an awful lot going on that I couldn't get to, although we talked to Norwood last week, and he was there talking about waste to energy, which will benefit Severstall.
Great.
But also benefit the city, that we'll be taking our own unique Dearborn
power
sewer waste
and
turning it into power for Severstall, and they'll buy it from us instead of DTE.
I love the idea. I love the idea. Can I know Joanne's